Essay.
Americans are naturally predisposed to reside in the land of the free, but there have been occasions in the past when certain segments of the population, motivated by fear of persecution and/or death, have beat a hasty retreat from their native land. Canada, our neighbor to the north, characterized by ice and royalist tendencies, has been the time-honored choice of hardy souls for whom continued residence in the United States has become morally or physically untenable. Because each American slave was counted as 3/5 of a person in the United States census, it's difficult to estimate the number who disappeared into the Underground Railway before the Civil War. However, at least 20,000 of them miraculously emerged as whole individuals at the end of the line in southern Ontario. During the Vietnam War, another instance of multiplying Americans, the tally of draft-age men who headed north is between 20,000 and 90,000, depending on where the calculation was made. In Puritan New England, before the rambunctious states were even united, there were many who should have gone to Canada but didn't. One of these was an elderly widow named Mary Webster, who in 1683 was accused of witchcraft in Hadley, Massachusetts, for having provoked a righteous gentleman to become valetudinarius. The distinguished cleric Cotton Mather prefaced his account of her trial with tender solicitation for his flock. "Among those judgments of God, which are a great deep, I suppose few are more unfathomable than this, that pious and holy men suffer sometimes by the force of horrid witchcrafts, and hellish witches are permitted to break through the hedge which our Heavenly Father has made about them that seek him. I suppose the instances of this direful thing are seldom, but that they are not never, we can produce very dismal testimony. One, and that no less recent than awful, I shall now offer, and the reader of it will thereby learn, I hope, to work out his own salvation with fear and trembling." The righteous gentleman died in his bed. Mary Webster was found guilty, strung up to a tree, and left overnight to die. But in the morning, she was discovered still alive. She lived another 14 years, doubtless without further interference from righteous gentlemen, and was known in her village and ultimately in history by the appellation Half-Hung Mary. Mary Webster was a distant relative of Margaret Atwood's on the maternal side. The surviving Websters, good Puritans all, impecunious and indifferent to rocks and ice, packed up their Bibles and emigrated to Nova Scotia, where land was cheap and daily existence more toilsome. Although Atwood's paternal ancestors were so quintessentially American they disembarked on our shores from the fabled Mayflower, they too migrated to Nova Scotia, where they fell in with the Websters, producing the current Atwood line. Were it not for these two defections, the celebrated Canadian novelist might have been a prime candidate for the DAR, or Daughters of the American Revolution, U.S. Women's Organization for the descendants of individuals who helped achieve American independence. Our loss, their gain, and not the first time. The Handmaid's Tale is dedicated to Mary Webster, as well as to Atwood's former professor at Harvard, Perry Miller, who introduced the nascent author to the fiery sermons of Cotton Mather and excited in her a curiosity about the uses of history. While it is ironic that this survivor's tale is dedicated to a witch and an academic, it is downright sardonic that the action is blatantly set at Atwood's alma mater, the famously entrenched hotbed of liberalism, Harvard University. The novel is a dystopian vision of a future in which Christian fundamentalists have executed the president, machine-gunned the Congress, blaming the assassinations on Muslim fanatics, suspended the Constitution, and created a new social order in which women are, at best, commodities. The United States has been disassembled, there is a continual state of war, and sectors run by the fundamentalists have been rechristened the Republic of Gilead. The patriarchs of Gilead hang the bodies of traitors on the wall of Harvard Yard, and control, with spies and secret police, the surrounding area, which locals once called the People's Republic of Cambridge. Offred, the narrator of The Handmaid's Tale, is a young American woman who, like her country, has been renamed. She was kidnapped and spirited to Gilead some years previous to the events of the novel. She does not know the fate of her husband or her daughter. They were captured by the soldiers of Gilead as they fled, like so many Americans before them, through a northern forest in a valiant, doomed attempt to emigrate to Canada. Canadians and Americans may look alike, Atwood has observed, but the contents of their heads are quite different. This difference is, in her view, the result of originating myths. The founding Puritans had wanted their society to be a theocratic utopia, a city upon a hill, to be a model and a shining example to all nations. The split between the dream and the reality is an old one, and it has not gone away. Canada suffers from no such split, since it was founded not by idealists, but by people who'd been kicked out of other places. Canada was not a city upon a hill. It was what you had to put up with. Atwood has described the impetus of The Handmaid's Tale as her steadily increasing perturbation at the expression, "It can't happen here," when she recounted her excursions into the darker side of religious fanaticism in Iran and Afghanistan. Her nonchalant American friends must have made this assertion once too often. The nightmare fate of her relative, half-hanged Mary, is proof not only that a brutal totalitarian takeover could happen here, but that in a very tangible sense, it has. When social upheaval results in political repression, and people are willing to trade individual rights for what they think of as security and order, Atwood contended in an interview, the form that repression takes is invariably a reversion to the original ethos of the nation. Were it to happen in America, the theocratic ambitions of the New England Puritans who tortured and hanged inconvenient women would provide the most obvious model. The Handmaid's Tale is thus an outraged response to the myth of American exceptionalism. A useful subtitle might be The Revenge of the Pilgrims. In a later interview, Atwood has spent a lot of energy trying to explain to American interviewers why Canadians are not Americans. She described America's fatal duality as encoded in the Constitution. America is a tragic country because it has great democratic ideals and rigid social machinery. Our Constitution promises peace, order, and good government, and that's quite different from life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This suggests a deeper fissure than the Puritans' appearance-reality split, namely the unbridgeable gap between the ideal of individual liberty and the ideal of social order, which Atwood has referred to as freedom to and freedom from. The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's sixth novel, was published in Canada in 1985 and in the United States in 1986. It was written in West Berlin and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, in the appropriate Orwellian year 1984, a coincidence Atwood has described as corny. It was her first novel to be set in America. She was, in a real sense, taking the measure of the voracious giant to the south, defining from above what it had been and might become. America was hungry for the bad news about itself, and The Handmaid's Tale was greeted with both critical acclaim and popular success. It was hailed as that most oxymoronic of hybrids, the instant classic. The buzz surrounding it was lively and came from bees of all stripes. Feminists, historians, sci-fi enthusiasts, and academic drones rushed to the scene. Its proper nomenclature excited creative genre labeling: anti-utopia, dystopia, cautionary tale, political satire, allegory, spiritual autobiography, feminist speculative fiction, futurist fable, and, my favorite, reconstructed post-print novel. The narrator's name, Offred, proved ambiguous and tantalizing, as tempting as the deep throat of a lily. Did it mean offered or afraid, or, peculiarly, off-read? One intrepid scholar claimed by close examination of the text to have ferreted out Offred's real name. Comparisons to Orwell and Huxley abounded. Everybody had a theory. 20 years have passed, and a vision that once seemed wildly imaginative has become weirdly prescient. The buzz has not subsided. A movie and an opera have spun off into the entertainment cosmos. Though the rise of Christian fundamentalism in the United States has not resulted in the creation of a thoroughly unrecognizable nation, some similarities to the Republic of Gilead are so evident as to be disturbing. The continued volume and variety of critical exegeses of The Handmaid's Tale suggests that the answer to the question, should one care to pose it, of what makes a novel an instant classic is this: its timeliness increases with time. Orwell's 1984 offers another example. We are now 20 years beyond what were conceived in 1948 as future events, Yet anyone who reads this novel today cannot fail to notice that the diminished language Orwell called Newspeak is on the rise. Harvard is where, but when is now? Gilead, when we discover it, appears to be in the future. Money has been replaced by the CompuBank, newspapers have been banned, atomic power plants have exploded on the San Andreas Fault, pollution and toxic waste have so poisoned the populace that many men are sterile, and should a woman manage to conceive, the chances of delivering a normal baby are 1 in 4. We aren't there yet, but the writing is on the wall. In the double story appended to the novel and entitled Historical Notes on the Handmaid's Tale, which comprises the transcribed proceedings of the 12th Symposium on Gileadian Studies at Nunavut, somewhere in the frozen north on June 25, 2195, Gilead is deep in the past, as illusory as Camelot, a lost civilization populated by what Philip Larkin calls fools in old-style hats and coats, quaint, non-threatening, gone. Gilead is both the future and history. Like the word utopia, which means both a perfect world and nowhere, Gilead is neither here nor there, but two places at once, and the events of the novel take place outside of time. For the reader, there is no now. Offred is curiously conscious of this. In the bland prison of her bedroom, she speculates about the nature of time. I lie, then, inside the room, under the plaster eye in the ceiling, behind the white curtains, between the sheets, neatly as they, and step sideways out of my own time. Out of time. Though this is time, nor am I out of it. The echo of Faust is not gratuitous. Offred is in that nowhere land between life and death, heaven and hell, a sulphurous room in which the figure of a man who has about him some quality of fallen nobility appears from out of nowhere to ask if you want to make a deal. The Handmaid's Tale is a novel of ideas, a narrative exploration of questions about power and powerlessness that preoccupy much of Atwood's fiction. She returned to them in her historical novel Alias Grace, and in her most recent speculative fiction, Oryx and Crake. Bodily Harm, the novel that preceded The Handmaid's Tale, is another provocative illustration. The narrator, Rennie, a lifestyles journalist, unsettled by an unpleasant experience in Toronto, a prowler has broken into her apartment and left a rope on her bed, takes off for a journalistic adventure on a Caribbean island and winds up on the wrong side of a revolution. Rennie prefigures Offred in a number of ways. In her blithe freedom, her plunge into darkness and powerlessness, her chilly observation of the opposite sex, and most notably, in her end, which is shrouded in possibility, unclear, unresolved. The questions raised are obvious, the answers less so. Atwood is always, first and foremost, a subversive writer. Woe to the critic who takes her at her word. The true story is vicious and multiple and untrue, after all. This line from Atwood's poem True Stories is a paradoxically true statement about the nature of her fictional universe. There are always at least two stories, and both of them can't be true at once. At least two, and all both true and untrue. The Handmaid's Tale is packed with doubles. Offred refers to them repeatedly. Off Glen, her companion on shopping trips. Doubled, I walk the street. Nick, the chauffeur with whom she is having a dangerous affair. We're mirrors. Her old friend Moira, a vigorous lesbian accustomed to bucking the system and willing to risk her life to escape the daily grind of Gilead, is her double. Serena Joy, the commander's wife, in whose lap she must lie during the extremely kinky sex required by the Gilead regime, is her double. Myself, my obverse, Offred calls her. The world Offred came from, where women had jobs and money and a degree of autonomy, is a double of the place she is now, where women are entirely defined by their bodies. This is a double of the Jekyll and Hyde variety. Near the end, closed in her bedroom at the commander's house, considering her options, of which she observes, not one seems preferable, and waiting for the duplicate of the experience she has already had, being abducted and taken to a place she knows nothing about, Offred encounters a final double, the nameless handmaid who occupied the room before her and scratched an encouraging message inside the wardrobe. Nolite te bastardes caberunderum. Don't let the bastards grind you down, before hanging herself from the light fixture. Behind me I feel her presence, my ancestress, my double, turning in midair under the chandelier, in her costume of stars and feathers, a bird stopped in flight, a woman made into an angel waiting to be found. By me this time. How could I have believed I was alone in here? There were always two of us. Get it over, she says. I'm tired of this melodrama. I'm tired of keeping silent. There's no one you can protect. Your life has value to no one. I want it finished. And then there are the doubles that can't exist without each other. Past and present, freedom and tyranny, time and space, male and female, particular emphasis on male and female, and night and day. Interestingly, the really frightening stuff happens in the daylight. A visit to the doctor, public hangings, the participation in which the handmaids rip a man to pieces with their bare hands while their keepers look on. Night is reserved for safer pastimes, like boring sex and Scrabble. In the war between the sexes, Atwood has constructed herself a lofty perch, which affords her a view that many find vertiginous. She's sometimes hard on women, most notably in Cat's Eye, which reveals the scary truth about what little girls are really like, and seldom easy on men. No male can read Offred's casual summing up of the male situation vis-a-vis the female without a shudder. To have them putting him on, trying him out, while he himself puts them on, like a sock over a foot, onto the stub of himself, his extra-sensitive thumb, his tentacle, his delicate stalked slug's eye, which extrudes, expands, winces, and shrivels back into himself when touched wrongly, grows big again, bulging a little at the tip, traveling forward as if along a leaf, into them, avid for vision. To achieve vision in this way, this journey into a darkness that is composed of women, a woman who can see in darkness while he himself strains blindly forward. Excruciating, yet not unsympathetic. Whose side is she on? In the gender wars, it has long seemed to me, if Atwood did not exist, we would be forced to invent her. The Handmaid's Tale offers the reader a proposition rich with irony, almost laughably simple. Suppose the daughter of a radical feminist, raised fatherless and fed a steady diet of anti-male propaganda, was spirited away to a patriarchal fundamentalist gulag where she was forced to have regular and supervised sex with a potential father figure. What would she think? Her situation is dire, and she seeks to make sense of it, to find a way to accept it. She has been captured. Her daughter and husband disappeared. She has been reprogrammed and dropped into a comfortable house to serve at the whim of the commander, a man whom she, curiously, can never find it in herself to despise, a man whose real name is Fred. Offred is an engaging narrator, and the story she tells, we are led to hope, is a survivor's tale. It is storytelling at what Atwood has called its most drastic, the story of the disaster which is the world. It is done by Job's messengers whom God saved alive because someone had to tell the story. I only am escaped alone to tell thee. When a story, true or not, begins like this, we must listen. So our sympathies are naturally engaged, and Offred's keen powers of observation, her mordant wit, her skill at conveying the desperation of her condition invite the reader to wish her well. She admits to what she sees as her faults. She is a physical coward. If tortured, she will say anything. She has unkind thoughts about her fellow handmaids, in particular the woeful Janine, who, in Offred's view, is weak, pandering, self-abnegating, without dignity. She is chagrined by her own sexuality, which in some perverse way got her into this fix. If she were old and ugly, she would have been sent to the colonies to shovel toxic waste, and guilty about betraying her husband, who may or may not be alive. Yet she is conscious of her sexual allure and willing to use it as a weapon. After she and her double, of Glenn, have passed a checkpoint while out doing the household shopping, she amuses herself with a fantasy about the young guards. As we walk away, I know they're watching. These two men who aren't yet permitted to touch women. They touch with their eyes instead, and I move my hips a little, feeling the full red skirt sway around me. It's like thumbing your nose from behind a fence, or teasing a dog with a bone held out of reach, and I'm ashamed of myself for doing it, because none of this is the fault of these men. They're too young. Then I find I'm not ashamed after all. I enjoy the power. Power of a dog bone, passive but there. I hope they get hard at the sight of us and have to rub themselves against the painted barriers surreptitiously. There's a marvelous crudeness to this encounter. One of the surprises in Offred's considerable bag of tricks is that she is both victim and tease. If the powers that be are going to reduce her to sex, then she will fight with what she has. That's one way of looking at it. There are others, such as taking her at her word. She enjoys power. Offred's great strength as a character is her failure to be noble. Her politics are not pure. She is selfish and capable of smallness. She is not the ideal female struggling against the patriarchy. She is too practical for that. She's just trying to get by. She sees herself as in reduced circumstances and determines as much as she can not to be herself reduced, but ultimately she knows she will fail. Just as she failed to live up to another idealistic regime, the radical, man-hating feminism of her mother, whose deep wisdom about the opposite sex was the adjuration, "A man is just a woman's strategy for making other women." The total information she offers her daughter about her conspicuously absent father is, he wasn't up to fatherhood. Not that I expected it of him. "Just do the job, then you can bugger off," I said. Offred's compensation for being raised without a father is the oft-repeated maxim, "You were a wanted child, all right. And did I get shit from some quarters?" As a child, Offred recalls, an excursion to the park was not, as she hoped, to feed the ducks, but to burn pornographic magazines. When Offred is an adult, happily married with a beloved daughter of her own, her mother dismisses her happiness. "As for you," she'd say to me, "you're just a backlash. Flash in the pan. History will absolve me." Offred is not without feeling for her mother, and she understands that in her cosmography, to be wanted is no small deal. "I admired my mother in some ways," she confesses, "although things between us were never easy. She expected too much from me, I felt. She expected me to vindicate her life for her and the choices she'd made." Offred tried hard, nor does she regret having tried, but she was doomed to fail the ultimate test of her mother's love. She has failed to hate men. Atwood has been accused of sneering at academia in the historical notes on The Handmaid's Tale, and it can't be denied that the last laugh is definitely hers. Critics of the novel are reduced to making little jokes about Atwood's little joke about academia. For the reader, once again, there are two stories, and this time it's easy to choose sides. Here is a swarm of useless gadflies making light of the imprisonment, rape, and possible murder of a woman we've come to know and love. How dare they? This is Atwood at her best, both playful and in deadly earnest. Orwell added a note on Newspeak to the end of 1984, indicating that somehow the world had survived Big Brother. Atwood's conference proceedings take us a step further. Gilead is gone, and we have not learned a thing from it. It is safely in the past. We are safe from it. The academics at the Gilead Symposium treat Offred's horrific tale of captivity as a blip on the big screen of history, and a tawdry blip at that. Offred herself is the subject of levity, but Professor Peixoto and his colleague have combed her narrative for clues to the real identities of the important men who abused her. Offred's story, rich with the detail of everyday life, what we ate, how we shopped, what shortages we endured, fish, moisturizer, what games we played, Scrabble, what the furniture was like, the gardens. I've tried to put in some good things as well. Flowers, for instance, because where would we be without them? Defies all efforts to minimize it. It's too solid and too ordinary. Here is the roof, here the door. There the walkway to the shops, here the wall where they hang the bodies with bags over their heads. This is Offred's method by which she hoards her sanity, recalling the lost world in which she was happy and describing the new world which she cannot escape. She does this with the same bewildered calm one hears again and again in the stories told by survivors of human brutality, from the Spanish Inquisition to the Balkans, from the Middle Passage to the Russian gulags. This is what we did. This is how we lived. This is what we had to do to stay alive. It is not an exculpatory tone. The thin light it sheds will not illuminate much. It won't tell us why people were so cruel and unjust then, but it can remind us of the way we do on any given day, explain our participation in the injustices we accept and perpetuate. It is what we do. The Handmaid's Tale is as much about history, and not just American history, but all of it, the whole disaster we call the world, as it is about the future. The Arctic Symposium makes this all too clear. It's too bad of these academics to laugh at Offred's fate. In fact, it's an outrage, but if it weren't for nosy, officious people like these, her voice would never be heard at all. They may not care for her or see in her struggle any significance for their own time, but at least they have allowed her to speak. They seem almost nostalgic for those bad old days when there was clearly no justice at all. The past, Professor Peixoto tells us, is a great darkness and filled with echoes. So we are forced to join the academics, looking back into that darkness, pretending we don't know what those echoes are saying. But Offred's voice speaks clearly, and this is what it says. History will catch up with us. It isn't dead any more than we are. It lives in and upon us, parasitically, like the bacteria in our intestines, without which we would die. If you want to see the future, keep looking steadily behind you, because the future, no matter how much we may pretend we don't know it, is history. Valerie Martin.